books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we're off to Scotland's book town as I visit Dumfries and Galloway and the Wigtown Book Festival. I'll talk to a historian about the brilliant life of the Duke of Buckingham, and we'll hear from a newsreader whose time on I'm a Celeb inspired her new thriller.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Coming up on today's show, Lucy Hughes Hallett will talk about The Scapegoat, the brilliant brief life of the Duke of Buckingham. And former BBC Breakfast presenter Louise Minchin will tell us all about how her time on I'm a Celebrity and her love of Agatha Christie inspired her new thriller, Isolation Island. That's all coming up on today's Read On, recorded at a noisy Wigtown Book Festival. Lucy Hughes Hallett was at Wigtown to discuss her book, The Scapegoat, the brilliant brief life of the Duke of Buckingham. From the winner of the Bailey Gifford Prize, it's an extraordinary story of the meteoric rise and fall of George Villiers, the first Duke of Buckingham. As King James I's favourite, Buckingham was also his confidant, gatekeeper, right-hand man and lover. When Charles I succeeded his father, he was similarly enthralled and made Buckingham his best friend and mentor. A dazzling figure on horseback and a skillful player of the political game, Buckingham rapidly transformed the influence his beauty gave him into immense wealth and power. The audio version of the book, The Scapegoat, is in the RNIB library and is just shy of 26 hours, and it was Lucy herself who narrated it.
He was called a devil, a spotted monster, a comet that disrupted the natural order, scrambled social hierarchy, and set the music of the spheres a jangle. He was accused of being a traitor to his country, an enemy of the people, and a regicide who poisoned the king who loved him. To royalists, he was the vulgar upstart who dragged the monarchy into disrepute and weakened it fatally. To Puritans and Republicans, he was the epitome of all the vices endemic at the degenerate court of the early Stuart kings. He was arrogant. He was greedy. His lust was insatiable. Yet here are the words with which those who knew him well described him: modest, courteous, kind, obliging, affectionate, generous, gracious, loving, and again, this is the word that recurs most insistently, modest. By all reliable accounts, George Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham, was really very nice. His beauty was extraordinary. Even those who hated him, and by the time of his death they were legion, never denied it. He was called the handsomest-bodied man in Europe, and one of the handsomest men in the whole world. Three monarchs loved him. King James I of England, 6th of Scotland, addressed him as sweetheart, or as my sweet child and wife, shared his bed with him, and told him that he would rather die than live without him. King Charles I worshipped him, as a nervous adolescent worships an older and infinitely more glamorous brother. The Queen of France, Anne of Austria, told a confidant that if it were possible for an honest wife to love anyone other than her husband, then Buckingham would be the man she chose. Many of her contemporaries believed that, honest or not, she had an affair with him.
The Scapegoat is the story of George Villiers, who was said to be the handsomest man in Europe. At the beginning of his life, that was really his only asset. Gorgeous legs, he was particularly famous for. And somehow it was contrived that he should be put in the way of King James VI of Scotland and First of England, who was well known to be interested in young men. King James had been in love for quite a long time with Robert Carr, who, thanks to being the king's favourite, had risen to being Lord High Chamberlain, Earl of Somerset, and the richest man in the two kingdoms. But Somerset had fallen from grace in a sensational way, which I won't go into at too much length because we're here to talk about Buckingham. But basically, Somerset and his wife had been found guilty of murdering his best friend, employing witchcraft and poisoned custard tarts. So there was a vacancy. The king was lonely, was looking for a new favourite, or rather other people were looking for such a person on the king's behalf. And word got out that there was this gorgeous young man around called George Villiers. And it was arranged that George Villiers, the future Duke of Buckingham, would appear at a royal hunt. And it was noticed that the king had noticed him. So basically, Buckingham, to begin with, you know, all he really had to offer were his amazingly good looks. And his beauty won him the king's love. The king's love brought him influence, and influence brought him immense wealth, and wealth, as it tends to do, brought him equally immense power.
This book is about Buckingham, but is not about him alone. Buckingham was described by contemporaries as a meteor, a shooting star. In speaking of him, people turned to astronomy for their imagery, because he seemed to them so grand, so brilliant. But he was not really a far-off heavenly body. His glamour was dazzling, but his life was shaped by the world he inhabited. His story forms the spine of my narrative, but because no man is an island, it is also a book about a society, its pleasures and passions, its beliefs and its politics. In early 17th century England, punctilious good manners were juxtaposed with extreme violence. Letters were thickly laced with flattery, but a courtier might have his hand amputated for a breach of protocol. It was a period of transition in which the past and future jostled. Archaic political structures were challenged by world-altering novelties, the beginnings of print journalism, the increasing power of public opinion. The Middle Ages had yet to end. There were witches. Medicine was not so much a science as a symbolic code, as likely to kill as to cure. Meanwhile, the Enlightenment had begun. Francis Bacon, Buckingham's mentor, was the great proponent of empirical scientific investigation.
Everything went along swimmingly, really, for Buckingham. For 10 years, he was lording it over the court of England and indirectly of Scotland. But then King James died, and things started to go badly wrong for him. King James dies in 1625, and James had been a steadfast pacifist. He refused to get drawn into any wars. He kept England and Scotland out of the ghastly sequence of conflicts that we now know as the 30 Years' War. But as soon as he was dead, Buckingham made it plain that he, along with a lot of other young men in England at the time, were finding this all a bit frustrating. They wanted to go to war. They wanted glory. And there was a lot of anxiety at this period about what we would nowadays call gender fluidity. And in a lot of pamphlets, in a lot of sermons even, you have people saying, oh, this extended period of peace was making Englishmen very effeminate. That word keeps coming up. And anyway, clearly Buckingham felt a bit of that. And the first sign that he was changing the nation's foreign policy was that he commissioned Rubens to paint a portrait of him in armour, riding into battle on a great big horse. He'd never actually engaged in any military expeditions at this point. But he told Rubens he wanted to be shown as a military commander, and so that's the picture he got. And then he started a war against Spain, and simultaneously a war against France. Absolute madness. And he turned out not to be very good at being a military commander. These expeditions weren't successful. Initially, the people were very excited. They called him St. George on horseback. They found this all rather thrilling, and a lot of men were kind of, you know, polishing their swords and looking forward to going into battle. But of course, once a war starts, it rapidly becomes obvious that A, people get killed, and B, it's very expensive. So taxation becomes very heavy, and then people lose their enthusiasm for warfare. And so Buckingham becomes more and more unpopular. People start to riot outside his houses, shouting for him to be got rid of. And eventually the people's representatives in Parliament try to impeach him. They keep failing to do so because King Charles, the new king, Charles I, stands by him and repeatedly dissolves Parliament in order to save Buckingham. But there comes a day when they describe it as the crisis of parliaments, and we have wonderful descriptions from news writers of the day of how in the House of Commons there were over 100 people in floods of tears, and they describe scenes which, I mean, they'd be comic if they weren't so tragic, actually, of the great orators of the House of Commons standing up, wanting to speak, and then sitting back down again because they can't get the words out. They're sobbing so much. And finally, up stands the great lawyer, Sir Edward Coke, who's 78 years old. He's been in the Tower of London before when he defied King James. And now he says, I know I shall never speak in this house again, so now I must speak freely. And he says, they've all agreed they're not going to talk about Buckingham because every time they do, King Charles dissolves Parliament. But Coke breaks the pact of silence. He says, the root cause of all this country's problems is the Duke of Buckingham. So King Charles throws a tantrum, dissolves Parliament again. Buckingham goes down to Portsmouth, where he's preparing another fleet to lead out against France. But Sir Edward Coke's speech is printed and is circulating on the streets of London, and it's read by a man called John Felton, a Puritan from Suffolk, who thinks, oh, well, if the Duke of Buckingham is the cause of all our miseries, I can do my country a great service. He buys a knife for 10 pence. He walks to Portsmouth. He can't afford a horse. He makes his way into the Greyhound Inn, where Buckingham has set up his headquarters. He gets into the room where Buckingham is having breakfast with his officers. Very busy, lots of people coming and going. No one notices Felton. And then when his moment comes, Felton steps forward and he kills the Duke of Buckingham with one blow to the heart.
This book is about big things, peace and war, Parliament and despotism. It is also about small things, babies, jewels, anemones. In it, I interleave the big with the small, aiming to make a collage that conjures up a life in all its complexity. 4 years after Buckingham's death, the Puritan polemicist William Prynne published Histriomastics. The book is primarily an attack on the theatre, but Prynne's targets are many and various. In the preface, he explains that he will be exposing the iniquity of the following: dancing, music, apparel, effeminacy, lascivious songs, laughter, adultery, obscene pictures, bonfires, New Year's gifts, grand Christmases, health drinking, long hair, Lord's days, dicing with sundry pagan customs. I would add a few more headings, among them connoisseurship and the collecting of art, hunting, pacifism, which to many people of the time seemed interchangeable with effeminacy, same-sex love and landscape design. But broadly speaking, I have nothing to say on dicing. Prynne's abominations correspond closely with the materials I have used to give substance to my picture of Buckingham and his world.
Did he have the same affections from Charles I as he did from James?
not the same, but certainly Charles loved him too. I mean, James was passionately in love with him. That they shared a bed, and that their relationship was erotic and romantic. Whereas Charles, I don't think there was anything of that kind between them. But Charles was younger than Buckingham, very nervous, shy. He had a terrible stammer. And as his subsequent career demonstrates all too clearly, he was very bad at the game of politics. Whereas Buckingham was confident, athletic, much more sort of charming and glamorous. And I think that King Charles sort of revered him in the way that a nervous younger brother might look up to a glamorous older brother.
Was Stilton a soldier under Buckingham?
He had been, yes. He'd fought at La Rochelle on the Ile de Ré when Buckingham was trying to lift the siege. The La Rochelle was a stronghold of the French Protestants, the Huguenots, and Buckingham tried to intervene to help the Huguenots against the Catholic powers of France. And in that conflict, Felton was wounded. He lost the use of one arm. And so that was one cause for him to feel resentment. Another was that he applied to be promoted to being a captain, didn't get it. But worst, he was never paid. And a lot of Buckingham's troops were never paid. So there was that was the root cause of a lot of the discontent.
Now, it's a large book and subsequently a very long audio book, which you recorded yourself. How was that?
It was very exciting. It was interesting. It was something I'd never done before, and I always like that, to, you know, acquire a new skill. And I did find that, of course, I know the book very well. I wrote it and wrote it and revised it, and I really knew it pretty intimately. But, of course, when you're reading a piece of text aloud, you approach it in a completely different way. And I did prepare very carefully for the recording, sort of going through and marking it up, you know, every pause, every stress. So I did my homework like an eager new pupil, because I hadn't done it before. And I'd had to rather kind of pester my publishers, who, you know, it's easier for them to employ an actor who probably, you know, has the skills down pat. But I worked hard at it, and I love doing it, and I'm pleased with it.
Now it's out there, it's accessible to anyone for whatever reason doesn't have access to print. Is that important to you?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, I'm on the whole someone who likes to read. I like to scribble all over my books, the horror of my husband, who's much more of a bibliophile, much more kind of reverent towards the book as a physical object. I even sometimes cut them in half with a bread knife, you know, if it's a thick paperback and I want to put half of it in my pocket and leave the other half at home. But I'm happy for people to have access to my book in any way that suits them.
Buckingham's personal story is entangled with a public one. On the one hand, two kings struggling to assert their royal prerogative. On the other, lawyers and members of parliament and preachers and polemicists doggedly striving to defend citizens' rights, in some cases sacrificing their own liberty to protect that of the people. In the middle, Buckingham, identified as the grievance of grievances, the causing cause of all the nation's discontents. He was a favourite. We no longer use that word. But still, four centuries on, every president, every prime minister, has their chief of staff or their special advisers, their consultants and aides. Those people are not elected. They do not pass through the civil service selection process. They owe their power to the ruler's favour, and they are accountable to that person alone. Their position is precarious. Francis Bacon warned Buckingham that often leaders, when the people begin to grumble, will sacrifice their favourites to placate the populace. When I began work on this book in 2020, large decisions about the way Britain was ruled were being made by one of the Prime Minister's staff, Dominic Cummings. He seemed to come, as Buckingham did, from nowhere. For a while he had power, but when the electorate became angry with the government, he was cast aside. He became a scapegoat, as Buckingham did 400 years before. In Buckingham's lifetime, it was very hard to criticise a monarch. To do so, even in one's silent thoughts, might be treason, and treason was a capital offence. 21 years after Buckingham died, the British people would kill their king. But first, they took out their hidden unhappiness on his favourite, reimagining him as a monster, and so opening the way to his death.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And despite sawing her books in half, we'll allow Lucy Hughes Hallett to come back for the books of my life at the end of today's show. Now, another person who would be horrified by the sawing up of books is Lynn Livingston of the RNIB Library. Let's catch up for some brand new audiobooks.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
A Place in the Sun by Joe Thomas was given to us by Penguin Random House.
You have arrived at your destination. Make a U-turn. Turn left. Make a U-turn. Turn right. You have arrived at your destination. It feels like Groundhog Day, but it's not wet or snowy like the film. It's hot. We have all the windows open. The aircon packed up when we were leaving France, and it's getting hotter. Make a U-turn. Turn left. Make a U-turn. All right, I say. Tired, flustered, and trying to switch off the sat-nav, punching the button. I stop the car and put my head into my hands. The heat sweeps in, wrapping itself around us, like a goose-down duvet. I fan myself with an empty paper bag from one of the many roadside meals we've had on our journey from the UK. At first I tried to make the road trip to Italy an adventure, and the B&Bs we've stayed in for the last couple of nights have been small, friendly and lovely. But now I want it to be over. I just want to have reached our destination.
Thea knew the holiday house her late husband Marco bought in Tuscany wasn't pristine. But when she relocates to Italy for the summer with her children, she's shocked by how much work Casa Luna needs, and she only has 6 weeks to fix it up ready to sell. Her only option is to ask the tight-knit Italian community for help. In return, Thea and her children become involved in the community kitchen, working alongside handsome chef Giovanni and three very competitive nonnas. Gradually, Thea begins to open up to the people around her for the first time in a long while. But just as she's beginning to wonder whether this small Tuscan town could become a new place to call home, a surprise visitor turns everything on its head.
"Mom," Luca says from the passenger seat beside me, iPad on his lap. "This could be it. It's like one of the pictures Dad took. Look at the village up there." He points towards a hilltop we must have driven past at least 3 times, maybe 4.
"Are we nearly there yet?" asks Amy from the back seat.
"Nearly, love."
"You said that ages ago," she says.
In the rearview mirror, I can see her flushed cheeks. "I know, love, but I promise we're nearly there now. Just wishing we could find the place."
"Make a U-turn,"
interrupts the sat-nav bossily. "You and I are going to fall out, lady." Amy giggles, cheering me up.
"She's not real, Mummy."
"Isn't she?" I tease. "I thought she was. I thought she'd eaten all the wine gums." Amy giggles some more.
"No, that was you."
"Me?" "It wasn't. It was the sat-nav lady. I heard her burp." And even Luca smiles. "It'll be fine," I tell myself firmly.
"She didn't. She's a machine," Amy laughs now.
In the rearview mirror, she's clasping Mr. Fluffy to her chest as I turn the car and set off up a narrow lane towards the hilltop village. It's overgrown and banked by tumble-down stone walls at either side, so tight that I'm not sure I should be driving along it. I've spent 3 days in the car with these two, and they've been brilliant. I couldn't be prouder. Luca has read the map all the way, regardless of the sat-nav. Belt and braces. Amy has watched films, played with her toys, and slept. Now I can smell the sun on the fields around us, and herbs. Rosemary, a hint of mint and wild fennel, as the car and wing mirrors brush against the hedge. Amy is still laughing, and I can't help smiling. "Mum, watch out!" Luca shouts, jolting my attention to the road. I slam on the brakes, and a man with 3 goats crosses from a field on one side of the road to another. I nod when he and the animals are safely over, and he nods slowly back. The children are no longer smiling, and I need to find the house. My tetchiness returns. "Well, she's clearly gone to sleep," I say, tapping at the sat-nav, but getting no response. I take the next left, then left again. It has to be around here somewhere.
A Place in the Sun by Joe Thomas is read by Anna Acton and runs for 7 hours and 37 minutes.
The Fathers by John Niven was donated by Canongate.
Yeah, Dan said. I'm a dad. Aye, the man said. Boy or gal? The accent rough, hard. A wee boy, Dan replied, beaming. Tom.
Magic. Congratulations, wee man. Me and all.
Really? Dan said. He laughed. This guy seems so calm. Well, congratulations to you too. You got a name yet?
Ach, Caden or Jaden. She's no sure.
Yeah, Dan said. He held out his hand. Dan.
Jada.
He looked at Dan's hand suspiciously for a moment, before he brought his own up slowly. His handshake was as brief as possible, as though shaking hands was something shameful, immoral, or just weird. As they shook, Jada noticed the stainless steel bracelet of Dan's watch, glinting in the milky light.
Relax, aye. Sub or a GMT. Grand and a half, maybe 2 for Big Malky, depending on the model.
In a busy maternity ward, first-time father Dan meets Jada, a dad welcoming his 6th child into the world. Dan and Jada come from very different places, both called Glasgow. Dan is a successful TV writer with a townhouse in the West End and a shiny Tesla ready to drive his wife and baby home. Jada is a hustling small-time criminal who is already planning how to separate Dan from some of the luxuries Jada has never been able to enjoy in his tiny flat in a council block. Both men find that the birth of their sons has fired their ambitions. Dan plans to walk away from his saccharine TV success and finally knuckle down to writing that novel he always felt he had in him. While for Jada, it's the opportunity for one last get-rich-quick scheme. When a tragedy occurs, their worlds are brought closer than either could have imagined, close enough that it could mean destruction for both of them.
He walked from the lounge through to the kitchen, a journey of just 5 paces that involved stepping over an overflowing carrier bag of empty lager cans, a plate heaped with the remains of a Chinese takeaway, the corpse of a busted Xbox, and the sleeping form of Bishop, his greyhound, and opened the fridge. Immediately, as the smell assaulted his nostrils, Jada conceded that this had been a mistake. There will have been refrigerators in human history that have contained a sadder inventory, but the list would be short. The main source of the smell seemed to be a crumpled tinfoil container of 3-day-old chicken tikka. This represented the most edible of Jada's victuals. A piece of cheese of indeterminate origin lay there on the shelf in the doorframe, its edges a grey-green warning colour, and he didn't need to pick up the half-empty litre of milk next to the cheese to know that its consistency was milkshake on the road to cottage cheese. On a wild impulse of irrational hope, and holding his nose now, he tugged open the salad crisper. A head of lettuce that Nicola must have bought lay there, its leaves completely white, the chlorophyll they once contained now forming the green puddle gluing it to the floor of its plastic tomb. Jada yelled to the very walls. He stood there in the narrow galley kitchen, hands on hips, nostrils flaring, and balefully surveyed his property, as though the flat itself might have been responsible for his foodless plight, rather than the fact that Nicola had been in hospital for 2 weeks now. He could see through the living room and down the short hallway to the two bedrooms at the end, the bathroom halfway along. A little over 800 square feet of living space up here on the 10th floor of the brutalist 60s block in Partick. The flat was so small that Jada could just about open the front door with an angled trainer dangled off the end of the couch.
The Fathers by John Niven is read by Angus King and runs for 11 hours and 16 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Lynn. We'll catch up with Louise Minchin about her book Isolation Island after this. Escape into the world of great literature with Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, hear from a complete unabridged classic from the RNIB library, beautifully narrated and specially selected for blind and partially sighted listeners. From timeless adventures to literary masterpieces, these serialised audiobooks let you enjoy a new chapter every day. And for younger listeners, don't miss Children's Talking Books every Saturday at 9 a.m. Perfect for the young at heart, and for sparking imaginations. Talking Books, every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
At the Wigtown Book Festival, I chatted to Louise Minchin about her first fiction book, Isolation Island. Louise went from presenting BBC Breakfast to competing for the GB team in triathlon in World and European Championships, a journey she charted in her first book, Dare to Try. In Fearless, she sets out to push herself even further, alongside trailblazing women who are breaking down barriers, smashing records, and challenging stereotypes. In every chapter, Louise goes on an adventure with a different woman to tell their story and to test herself. She narrates the audio version herself.
Are you okay? No, I'm not. I've had enough. I cannot interview yet another man about his adventures. What about all the women doing incredible things? The fearless females? Why don't we talk to them? Why aren't they on the sofa being interviewed? Why don't we hear their stories? That was the moment for me, the moment I decided to write this book. I was fed up of being complicit with the narrative that it is only men who deserve to be celebrated, only men who are brave, only men who stretch the limits of what is humanly possible. I was done with telling only one side. Why? Because being talked about and being seen matters. If you don't hear it and you don't see it, how can you be it? We need equal representation. I had to write this as a journalist, as an endurance athlete, and as a mother to two daughters because, with respect to all the men I've interviewed, women and girls need heroes too. Heroes who look like them. And by the way, I'd argue that men like to hear the stories of heroic women too. I had already fought and won some important battles for equality during my TV career, including a bruising and long-winded fight to get paid the same as my male co-presenters sitting next to me. The other battle was to make sure that women presenting BBC Breakfast were allowed occasionally to lead the programme. I had noticed that almost every day my male colleague was given the prestigious task of saying hello at the top of each hour, introducing the programme, doing the first interview. Once I had noticed how often it happened, I couldn't unsee it. Why was it happening? Why was I always the second person to speak, even though I was older and more experienced? What message did it send to all our female viewers? That I wasn't as important as my male counterpart? That I was second fiddle? That I didn't deserve to be there? What implication did that have for their own lives and their own careers? I thought it was unfair, unequal, and also immensely damaging.
Louise Minchin, reading from her book, Fearless. As we'll find out, her appearance in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here gave her the idea for her first fiction book, Isolation Island, which is narrated by Daphne Kuma.
Perched precariously above a jagged, geometric tumble of high cliffs is the forbidding silhouette of the monastery, etched against the sky. A tall circular watchtower dominates the scene, like an exclamation mark, a stark warning to anyone who approaches that they are being observed at all times. It dwarfs the belfry, which still stands defiant next to the derelict remains of the chapel, destroyed in a fire decades ago. Here and there the walls are pulled apart entirely, torn down by merciless gales that have sent masonry smashing into pieces on the rocks below. Everything about it is foreboding, a place to scare you away, not welcome you in. In Lauren's endless hours researching the history and geography of Aelin Manach, nothing has prepared her for the starkness of its wind-torn reality.
Isolation Island is about 10 celebrities who are going to go to an isolated island off the northwest coast of Scotland to take part in the toughest of tough reality shows. Think I'm a Celebrity with Traitors and Agatha Christie and Then There Were None, all of those put together. And there is a storm on the way, a once in a 100-year storm. And you may be able to guess, they are going to get cut off from everybody. They're going to be all on their own in this derelict monastery and things are going to go badly wrong for them. It's a thriller. Someone will die.
As she takes in her new home, the boat steadies. It has entered the lee of the island, and the sea is no longer choppy. The rolling waves have dispersed. For the first time, Lauren begins to take serious notice of her fellow passengers. She needs to start thinking of them as contestants, competitors, not just a ragtag bunch of semi-famous faces. All of them are in motion, talking feverishly amongst themselves. Beside her, Max straightens from his crouch at last. She watches him as his eyes fix on the monastery. For a moment, his face holds a curious blankness. No fear, no excitement, no enthusiasm. It is as though he is looking inward, not outwards at the forbidding sight ahead. Then he blinks and becomes the brash, hearty sportsman she has seen in so many interviews and on numerous quiz shows.
Jesus, would you look at that, he says. I don't reckon it's going to be a five-star stay. By the state of the place, my money is on some of us not even surviving a couple of days.
Is it based on your experience, well, not in the jungle, I was going to say, but in I'm a Celebrity in the Welsh castle when a storm hit?
It's exactly inspired by the moment when I was on I'm a Celebrity back in 2021 in a castle in North Wales, and this once in a 100-year storm came and took the programme off air. It ripped off the roofs of all the production teams, caravans or wherever they're working, studios, and trees came down and lashing rain, and the programme was taken off air. And when I left, I was put in a taxi in the middle of the night, in the dark and the lashing rain, going to I didn't know where and I didn't know how long for. And I just thought, I have got the most brilliant location for a thriller, a reality TV show that goes spectacularly wrong.
You have 10 minutes to put on your habits and place everything you came with into the large sack with your name on and hand it over. Put everything in. Anyone who doesn't obey to the letter comes back with me to the mainland. Game over, no discussion.
Despite bubbling groans of complaint, everyone does what he says. As quickly as they can, and hopping comically from one foot to another, they start to pull off their damp clothes and strip down to their matching dark blue thermals, which they had been told to wear under their other clothes. It is hardest for the kayakers, who are inhibited by their tight-fitting dry suits, and there is a moment of hilarity when Nico and Jackson try to assist Frank, who is struggling to get his legs out of the rubberized cuffs. They pull at his arms so hard that he loses his balance, topples backwards, and lands sprawled on the sand, laughing along with the rest as Matt gives him a hand up and a pat on the back. 10 minutes later, they are all transformed. 10 brown figures, all dressed exactly the same in matching hooded monk's habits, stripped of the trappings that marked out their individuality. As they stuff their own clothes back into their sacks, the air is full of laughter and good-natured mockery.
Never played a monk before. This could be a right laugh.
And there's an obvious love of Agatha Christie in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tried not to read or go anywhere near And Then There Were None when I was writing it, because I just thought, I don't want to be any more influenced than I am already. And then shortly after finishing the second draft, or maybe last draft, I listened to And There Were None, mm-hmm. and I could not believe how much that book is literally in our DNA. There were so many things. So it's a very similar, dark, malevolent place, my island and also the one there. So yeah, absolutely inspired by that.
Now, we have your books, Fearless and Dare to Try, in the RNIB library, narrated by you. But for this one, you handed it over to Drafty Kuma. Why did you decide not to narrate this one?
I wasn't invited to read this one. I had to audition to read Dare to Try and Fearless, which luckily I passed the auditions, given that I used to read out loud for an actual living. I was pleased with that. And I'd written those books myself. But this one needed an actor because there are 10 different characters and I couldn't do the voices. So, but you know what? Next time I might be really tempted to do it, because it's so interesting, isn't it? Because I listen to them all the time, by the way. And they, you know, they really change your judgment of a character in so many ways. So next time I might try and give it a go. But she's done a great job. She's brilliant as Lauren, who's my main character, who's an investigative journalist. And thank you, Daphne, for doing such a great job.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from an online source is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Oh, yes. So the cover, I absolutely love the cover and had quite a lot of discussions about the cover. So on the cover, you've got the derelict monastery, and the belfry is really important in Isolation Island. So you've got that right heart and centre of this island, and it's a tiny island. It'll take you maybe half an hour to walk around it. So you've got this tiny island, you've got the trees on the island, you've got a brilliant kind of quite threatening though sunset in the back, because we know it kind of gives you an idea that there is a storm either coming or has been there, and also the water, which is dark and blue and has these kind of bubbles, and the water takes up about half of the cover. Isolation is above the water, island is below the water, and I love it because it absolutely says what it does on the tin. You know you're going to get a dark story, you're probably going to be chilled by it, and it's definitely slightly scary cover, but in a really good way.
What about my sunglasses? They cost me a fortune!
Nico is showing every sign of having a meltdown until they realise that Taisy's perfect face has crumpled into real, distressed tears. Holly reaches out to pull her into a hug.
My photo! Holly, that's my photo in there. I know you said not to bring it in case it got lost, but I just needed it near me, and now it's gone.
Holly strokes Taisy's hair and looks up at the row of puzzled faces. It's a picture of her mum. She died not long ago. A distant memory stirs in Lauren. her niece telling her how distraught she and all Taisy's fans were for her when she revealed her loss. A murmur of sympathy goes up and Holly speaks louder into Taisy's ear. Taisy, come on now, it's fine. You know you've got copies of that photo, it's your screensaver. And then, a little more sharply, Taisy, don't do this. It's fine, you are going to be fine. Taisy sniffs and her face emerges from Holly's shoulder. She gulps a few times, then gives a weak smile. Sorry. So sorry. That was just silly of me. I just wanted to feel like she was here with me. Sorry, Halls. You were right. The others cluster for a group hug. The cynical side of Lauren wonders how much of their display is genuine empathy and how much is for the watching cameras. But there's no doubt Taisy looks more cheerful when she emerges. The metallic double cough of a motor starting breaks them apart. Without a final word, the captain has returned to the rib and is readying it for the return journey.
Daphne Kuma reading Isolation Island by Louise Minchin, which is available in print as an ebook and an audio commercially. Louise's non-fiction books, Dare to Try and Fearless, are both available from RNIB Talking Books. And finally, on today's show, a return to Lucy Hughes Hallett for the books of her life.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with your reading?
Well, there were an awful lot of them. But I think that probably the most important thing was that my mother used to read aloud to me, an awful lot, to me and my brothers. And I think that she had a very good principle, which is that she believed that children can understand almost anything. Because after all, you know, children have learnt to speak English, or whatever their language is, from scratch in only a few years. Children are much cleverer than grown-ups. And so she tended to read aloud from books that would now be thought rather too grown-up for small children. There's a great stroke of luck for children, which is that some of the best fiction in the English language contains child characters, so that David Copperfield, Jane Eyre, people think of those as children's books because they have child protagonists. Mm. And I can remember her reading David Copperfield to me when I was, you know, I certainly couldn't read. I couldn't read over her shoulder. I don't know how old I was. And that stayed with me. And actually, that's going to bear fruit many, many decades later, in that my next book is going to be about Dickens's female characters, including, of course, Betsy Trotford, a very important person.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike and I began to cry simultaneously. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, it was declared by the nurse and by some sage women in the neighbourhood who had taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted, first, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits, both these gifts inevitably attaching, as they believe, to all unlucky infants of either gender born towards the small hours on a Friday night. I need say nothing here on the first head, because nothing can show better than my history whether that prediction was verified or falsified by the result. On the second branch of the question, I will only remark that unless I ran through that part of my inheritance while I was still a baby, I have not come into it yet. But I do not at all complain of having been kept out of this property. And if anybody else should be in the present enjoyment of it, he is heartily welcome to keep it. I was born with a caul, which was advertised for sale in the newspapers at the low price of 15 guineas. Whether sea-going people were short of money about that time, or were short of faith and preferred cork jackets, I don't know. All I know is that there was but one solitary bidding, and that was from an attorney connected with the bill-broking business who offered £2 in cash and the balance in sherry, but declined to be guaranteed from drowning on any higher bargain. Consequently, the advertisement was withdrawn at a dead loss. For as to sherry, my poor dear mother's own sherry was in the market then. And 10 years afterwards, the call was put up in a raffle down in our part of the country to 50 members at half a crown a head, the winner to spend 5 shillings. I was present myself, and I remember to have felt quite uncomfortable and confused at a part of myself being disposed of in that way.
That's Nigel Carrington reading David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, available in both audio and braille from RNIB Library. There's also an alternative reading available in the library, as read by Ed Spilliers.
And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Well, actually, to go back to one I've already mentioned, I adore Jane Eyre, and I read it over and over again. I think that, like, almost every female reader who's ever read Jane Eyre, I think it's about me.
Reader, I married him. A quiet wedding we had. He and I, the parson and clerk, were alone present. When we got back from church, I went into the kitchen of the manor house, where Mary was cooking the dinner and John cleaning the knives, and I said, "Mary, I've been married to Mr. Rochester this morning." The housekeeper and her husband were both of that decent, phlegmatic order of people to whom one may at any time safely communicate a remarkable piece of news without incurring the danger of having one's ears pierced by some shrill ejaculation and subsequently stunned by a torrent of wordy wonderment. Mary did look up, and she did stare at me. The ladle with which she was basting a pair of chickens roasting at the fire did for some 3 minutes hang suspended in air, and for the same space of time, John's knives also had rest from the polishing process. But Mary, bending again over the roast, said only, "Have you, miss? Well, for sure." A short time after, she pursued, "I seed you go out with the master, but I didn't know you were gone to church to be wed." And she basted away. John, when I turned to him, was grinning from ear to ear. "I told Mary how it would be," he said. "I knew what Mr. Edward—" John was an old servant and had known his master when he was the cadet of the house, therefore he often gave him his Christian name. "I knew what Mr. Edward would do, and I was certain he would not wait long either. And he's done right for aught I know. I wish you joy, miss." And he politely pulled his forelock. "Thank you, John. Mr. Rochester told me to give you and Mary this." I put into his hand a 5-pound note. Without waiting to hear more, I left the kitchen. In passing the door of that sanctum some time after, I caught the words, "She'll happen do better for him nor any o' the grand ladies." And again, "If she bent one of the handsomest, she's none foul and very good-natured. And in his e'en she's fair beautiful. Anybody may see that."
That's Lucy Scott reading from Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. Available from RNIB Talking Books. It's also available in Braille.
Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in mind you'd like to recommend.
I've been reading Helen Garner's Diaries. Helen Garner, wonderful Australian author who's written fiction and non-fiction as well. And these are her diaries that she's now of a certain age, but they were written mostly in the 1970s and 80s. And they were written, I mean, they just were her diaries. She's edited them to make a coherent narrative, but I don't think she's added anything to them. And they are fantastic. You feel you're in direct contact with a really vigorous, original, interesting mind. They're terrific.
Home from hospital, minus various worn-out internal organs, flat-bellied and sore. Strange nerve shootings in my legs, as if there were a tightly yanked electric wire between ankle bone and groin. Any sudden movement and zzzt, it flashes. A hot, yet cold, dry, yet liquid jolt. My widowed sister comes up from Melbourne for a week to help V look after me. She says I look pale and washed out. She shops and cooks and washes and irons, urges me with her nurse's severity to get up and move every hour or so. One night she washed my feet in a bucket of warm water, buffed them with a towel on her lap, then massaged them with skin cream. She has opinions on world affairs and on the claustrophobia of our flat, which she expresses in a carrying voice. V can barely endure our presence here in daylight hours, bloody fussy women. I need fuss. She's gone home. I miss her. I'm still too weak to go to work. He shuts himself in his room, and I shuffle about by myself, up to the cross, down to the park. My agent says The First Stone has sold 40,000 copies. Letters pour in, and I answer them. A librarian tells V she was so appalled by the way a feminist in long dangly earrings attacked me on TV that she resolved never to wear dangly earrings again. To think that my book might affect fashion. V's gone to Canberra. I had two thick slabs of fresh pineapple and five cloves of boiled garlic for dinner and slept under an extra blanket. Fresh attacks in this month's Australian Book Review. Now they're claiming I invented dialogue and wrote hypothetical meetings with imaginary characters. I permitted myself the luxury of a quick and savage retort.
How to End a Story, Diaries 1995 to 1998, written and read by Helen Garmer, is available in audio commercially. Thanks once again to Lucy Hughes Hallett. Her books, The Pike, Gabrielle D'Annunzio, Poet, Seducer and Preacher of War, Fabulous, Peculiar Ground, a novel, and of course The Scapegoat, the brilliant brief life of the Duke of Buckingham, are all available from RNIB Library.
That's all we've got time for on today's Read On. We'll be back for more from the Wigtown Book Festival and from the Booker Shortlist in the next few weeks. Every episode of Read On is available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. Or tune in to our sister show every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. where we serialise one of the best books from the RNIB Talking Books collection that we're allowed to play on air. For more information on the station, just search for RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.